Welcome to Opera Out of the Box, unpacking opera piece by piece. I'm your host, Brad Cresswell. We're continuing our series of conversations that lead up to Toledo Opera's production of South Pacific in February, and today we're welcoming Dr. Peter Mansour. Now, I have a fanfare for you. Let's see. Welcome, sir.
Pleasure to be here. Thanks for having me on.
We welcome guests with a little fanfare. I hope that was up to your standards.
Well, given that I just finished a book on General Douglas MacArthur, I know what fanfares are all about.
Well, you mentioned General Douglas MacArthur, and your book is called Redemption. The whole title here, MacArthur and the Campaign for the Philippines. So it's a comprehensive exploration of his life. And what do you mean by redemption? What can you tell us about this book?
There are very few military leaders who have been defeated in battle and have returned on the same ground against roughly the same enemy to win in the end. I mean, the number is, you know, in the single digits. And the other person in World War II that I can think of is Field Marshal William Slim in the Burma campaign. He was there when the Japanese took over Burma, and he refashioned the Commonwealth 14th Army into a killing machine. And by 1945, he had liberated Burma again from the Japanese on the same ground that he had been defeated on in 1942. And same thing with MacArthur in the Philippines.
Well, before we dive into this really deeply, let's get a little introduction from you so people know who you are, right? You're on faculty at Ohio State University, but you also have a military pedigree. I wonder if you can talk a little bit about yourself.
Sure. So I was born in Minnesota and moved to California when I was six, raised in Sacramento, and then I went to West Point, where I was a member of the class of 1982. And spent 26 years in the military, in the U.S. Army as an armor officer. Had two tours in the Iraq War, one as a brigade commander in Baghdad in 2003 and 2004. And then I finished up my service as executive officer to General David Petraeus, commander of Multinational Force Iraq, during the surge of U.S. forces in 2007 and 2008. And I retired as a full colonel rather than competing for brigadier general because Ohio State, my graduate alma mater, I have a PhD from Ohio State that I got in 1995 because I had taught military history at West Point as part of my duties. They came and they said, would you like to compete for the General Raymond E. Mason Jr. Chair of Military History, which was the chair that my PhD advisor held. Yeah. But he was retiring, and they wanted someone to take his place, and they liked my work, and which was on World War II. And so I put in my name in the hat and competed and got the position. So I retired in 2008, and I've been teaching military history at the Ohio State University.
Yeah, you haven't really retired, I would say. Well, I mean, I feel completely inadequate to interview you. That's why Leah Whitaker is here from Toledo Opera. She's development director. Welcome, Leah.
Hey, Brad.
You have a lot of questions for Dr. Mansour. Can I call you Peter or Pete?
It would be Pete if you want to use my first
name.
General Petraeus once said that all superheroes needed a one-syllable name.
Uh-huh.
So I shortened it from Peter to Pete.
Brad, you've got some chance there.
Yeah, that's right. Well, I mean, when most people think of General Douglas MacArthur, who is the subject of your book, they think of I Shall Return, or as Arnold Schwarzenegger says, I'll be back. they think of that, and they think of the movies, Gregory Peck. I mean, what kind of a person was he really, right?
Well, he was, I would say, a Victorian man of destiny. He believed that in the end he had an enormous role to play in this world. And he shaped his life and his career to fulfill that goal. He was vainglorious and very conceited. And, you know, it was all about him. All the press releases coming out of the Southwest Pacific Theater were all, I think someone did a count, and about 85% of them mentioned one person and one person only, and that was General Douglas MacArthur. But on the other hand, he was an excellent strategist. He took his objectives with minimal loss of life, for the most part. There were some exceptions to that. But he learned from those battles. And in the end, he was able to liberate the Philippines at, I would say, a very moderate cost in American blood and treasure, and did a great thing for the United States and the Filipino people in doing so.
Well, there's a difference, obviously, between what really happened, which is your purview, and what happens in the musical South Pacific, right, which is sort of our purview here. And before we talk about all of that, I want to have a bit of a quiz here. There are only five questions here, so this will be easy. It's called the Pacific Theater Quiz. So theater meaning musical theater, the musical itself, South Pacific, and the Pacific Theater during World War II, right? So let me get up some music here, some good South Pacific music.
Wow.
Get us in the mood. All right. So what I'll do is I'll read these questions, and we'll go to Peter first.
Sure.
He'll give his answer, and then we'll go to you, Leah.
Okay, I'll agree with him.
Why do I think I'm being set up?
I agree with Peter.
Yeah. Well, I'm tempted not to say what the options are. I do have three options, but first I'll see if you know it right off.
Ask him first without multiple choice, and then you can give me options.
Okay.
Okay.
All right, Pete, here's your first question. Which battle marked the first significant defeat for the Japanese Navy? What do you say?
Well, I would say the Battle of the Coral Sea.
Right, and I also have the Battle of Midway and the Battle of the Philippine Sea. The Battle of Coral Sea is one of them. Do you agree, Leah?
Yeah, that's exactly what I was going to say.
Okay.
I didn't know that.
You both are correct.
Just to confess.
Yeah, you know, this is an educational podcast, too,
yeah.
Right? We've been everything.
It was a strategic defeat for the Japanese. In terms of ship losses, it was sort of equal, but
okay.
No, we won't go into that.
Let me ask you this question. Who wrote the music for South Pacific?
Rodgers and Hammerstein.
Yeah, it was Richard Rodgers was the actual composer. Okay. Do you agree with that?
I do, or I'd be fired.
Yeah, right. Indeed. Third question. What code name was given to the U.S. campaign to capture the Mariana Islands? I'll leave that to you, Peter. Was it Operation Galvanic, Operation Forager, or Operation Cartwheel?
Cartwheel.
No, it wasn't Cartwheel. Not the Marianas. Oh, my God. I'll say Galvanic.
Galvanic, do you agree? Leah?
I'm sort of cheating here with notes. I'll agree with him.
Mm-hmm. Well, I've got Operation Forager, which encompassed more than the Mariana Islands. Okay, what was the main purpose of the Doolittle Raid in April 1942? Was it A, to weaken Japan's air defenses, B, to boost American morale and demonstrate Japan's vulnerability, or C, to cut off Japanese supply lines?
Definitely B.
Definitely B.
You both agree with that?
Absolutely.
All right. You got that.
Who was that named after? Not Dr. Doolittle.
I think it was James Doolittle,
I think
was his name. He was a
like
general,
a
maybe, or...
Okay.
He wasn't a general, I don't think.
He was a colonel at the time.
Colonel,
of the
yeah.
He ended up the war as a 3-star general and the commander of the 8th Air Force in Europe.
Well, I was kind of
what
right.
What a show-off.
He ended up as a general. Okay, I've got one last question for this quiz. Who originated the role of Emile Debeck in the Broadway production? Was it A, Ezio Pinza, B, Alfred Drake, or C, Yul Brynner? What do you say, Pete?
Oh, God, I have no idea. I'll take A, just because it's the first one.
Yeah, do you agree, Leah?
Should I? I'll say Yul Brynner.
You'll say Yul Brynner. You are incorrect,
yeah.
But Pete is correct.
Oh, okay.
It was A, Ezio Pinza. Okay, we'll get back to that a little bit later, but let's talk about what the infantry went through and what they faced and what they felt and sort of the side that we don't see of them concentrating on the infantry and you know, people who were
on the ground,
ostensibly, right in the middle of the action there.
The fighting in the South Pacific was horrific. One of the most difficult theaters for an infantry soldier to operate in World War II, and that's saying a lot. You know, they were battling the Japanese, of course, but they were also battling Mother Earth and the elements, the heat, the humidity, the disease. Far more soldiers were incapacitated by malaria than any other disease in the South Pacific. And it wasn't, we didn't get a handle on it for about a year. Entire divisions would be incapacitated by malaria and had to be withdrawn from combat and given time to, you know, basically have the malaria burn out of their systems before they were put back into the line. Finally, U.S. scientists synthesized a drug, atabrine, which German scientists had first synthesized, the Bayer company in 1931.
Yeah, and makers of aspirin. Right?
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. But also makers of atabrine, which is a prophylactic for malaria. And because the quinine supplies had been cut off, the Japanese had taken the places where quinine was produced. And finally, when soldiers were given atabrine and that taking it was enforced, they were able to overcome that disease. But, you know, fighting the Japanese and the jungle at the same time, it was tough. Going back to your comment on racism, there's a book by John Dower called War Without Mercy, and in it he posits that one of the reasons why fighting in the Pacific was so horrific is the intense racism that the Japanese held the Americans, and then the same view the Americans had of the Japanese as sort of ape-like figures and less than human soldiers. And there were very few prisoners taken in a lot of these battles simply because the Americans were suspicious of the Japanese. When they surrendered, they often, you know, would explode hand grenades that were hidden under their clothes and killing a lot of people. And so they simply wouldn't take prisoners. And the Japanese themselves were, you know, mistreated the prisoners that they took because they saw, in their view, surrendering was dishonorable. And so they treated their prisoners horrifically, the Bataan Death March being a good example of that.
Wow.
You know, I know that in the World War II propaganda, there was a real difference between the way that the European German enemies were portrayed in media and then versus the really, like you mentioned, the ape-like depictions of the Japanese. Do you think that racism is part of the reason what made dropping the bomb easier for us?
There's a lot of reasons why we dropped the bomb. The major reason was that President Truman felt it would reduce casualties that would occur if we had to invade Japan. And he's no doubt correct in that regard. Historians look back and think that if the European war had somehow been extended into 1946, the first bomb would have been dropped on Berlin.
Okay.
So I'm not sure that it was racism that tipped the balance there.
Okay.
Yeah.
But certainly the soldiers and sailors, airmen, and Marines applauded when the Japanese surrendered, and they didn't really care how many people were killed in the process.
So getting back to General Douglas MacArthur, and who is the subject of your book, Redemption? We'll link to where people can find that online. But I want to ask you about Douglas MacArthur because, you know, Leah mentioned the bomb, and MacArthur basically wanted to drop the bomb on all of our enemies, right? Am I making that up, or is that so?
Well, this comes later in his Korean War experience.
Right.
When the Chinese intervened in the conflict in the fall of 1950. And in retaliation, he wanted to take the war to China, the communists had recently taken over the country. And he wanted to expand the conflict. He wanted to bring in the nationalist Chinese from Formosa, now Taiwan, into the conflict. He wanted to use the U.S. Air Force to bomb Chinese targets in Manchuria, including using the atomic bomb, which was our wonder weapon of the time.
Yeah.
Of course, President Truman felt much differently about the whole matter and General MacArthur ended up getting relieved for overstepping his authority.
Is that the "I'll be back" thing that he said to the members of the Philippines?
No, no, that was in World War II.
Okay.
So he had been ordered by President Roosevelt at the time to withdraw from the Philippines. President Roosevelt did not want Douglas MacArthur being captured, which would be a huge coup for the Japanese.
Right.
And while he was traveling through Australia on the way to his new headquarters in Melbourne, he thought that he was being ordered to Australia to get an army together and get an air force together and ships together to go back to the Philippines. And he thought, like, right away, within a matter of weeks or months. And so on one of the stops in Australia, he said, "I have been ordered out. I've been ordered to Australia by the president for the purposes of which I assume are to gather reinforcements. I have made my way through and I shall return." And the War Department cabled him and said, "Shouldn't you have said we shall return?"
Leah, you want to jump in with another question for?
Well, yeah. Pete? So what I learned of the South Pacific War was, I mean, it's all the island hopping. It's the island hopping strategy. Mm. And I'm curious to know, like, what, first of all, my understanding now is that there was sort of a division between the north, what was happening in the northern part of the Pacific and the southern part, and they had sort of different operational strategies and goals. But how were the islands being selected? Was it sort of a sequential, like hop, hop, hop all the way up to Japan? Was it based on...
We should say what island hopping is first, so people know, because I didn't know until I did a little preparation for this conversation.
Yeah, so maybe we could talk about island hopping. I want to know, like, which islands, like, how were they selected? You know, were they fortified in a certain way? Were they already, you know, owned by the Japanese? Like, how did the strategy roll out there?
Okay, so let's talk about the strategy itself. It would have made sense to put all U.S. forces in the Pacific under a single commander. But because the Pacific is an ocean mostly, that would have been a naval commander, Chester Nimitz. And there was no way the Army was going to agree to that, especially since Douglas MacArthur outranked him. Mm. And so what the Joint Chiefs of Staff did is they divided the Pacific into two major avenues of advance against Japan. One would be in the Central Pacific under Chester Nimitz, and that would start in the Gilbert Islands at Tarawa in November 1943 and work its way up to through the Marshalls and into the Mariana Islands in Operation Flintlock, right? and then the other major avenue was MacArthur's avenue in the Southwest Pacific Theater. And that would be a battle mostly for New Guinea, ending in the Philippines. And then kind of sandwiched in between the two theaters was the South Pacific, which began at Guadalcanal with the Marines landing in August of 1942, and then worked its way up through the Solomon chain. So that's the strategic level. It was twin drives in the Pacific, only made possible because the United States is such a rich country, we could have produced enough manpower and units and materiel to have both drives succeed. The other thing is the operational way that these campaigns were conducted. And this is where the island hopping comes in. So islands in the Pacific were only important for one of two reasons, ports or airfields. They either had ports or lagoons, huge lagoons that could be turned into a port, like at Ulithi Atoll, that could house U.S. naval units, or they had airfields that could house fighters and bombers. That's the only reason islands were important. And so what the U.S. Commanders would do is they would take an island that had a, for instance, Tarawa, had an airfield. Most of the island was an airfield. That's all it was. And so they took that island, and then they would look at the next stage of the campaign, which was to go to the Marshall Islands, and they're like, well, where should we go there? Well, let's bypass all these islands that have no ports or airfields, and we'll go to Aniwetok, which they did, or we'll go to Kwajalein. And then they would bypass islands that were of no importance and island hop over those islands into islands of more importance. In New Guinea, this took the form of MacArthur bypassing Japanese garrisons on the north coast of New Guinea and hopping around them For instance, in April 1944, he did a 500-mile leap to Hollandia, which was a huge coup, landing behind the Japanese army that was guarding the New Guinea coast. So that's what island hopping was all about in the Pacific.
Were they meeting Japanese combatants at every island? I mean, you just mentioned skipping around. So the goal was not to meet the enemy, defeat the enemy. When you say take an island, could it have been at times as easy as showing up and putting your troops on it? Or was it always meeting the Japanese on these islands? And if so, how did the Japanese get there so quickly and take over all these islands?
Well, the Japanese were there since the campaign in 1941 and 42. So from December 7th, 1941 through roughly the Battle of Midway in June of 1942, they took these islands, which were not garrisoned. So they basically just landed. But for the U.S. forces and Australian forces to go back, they had to fight for these islands because the Japanese had fortified them. So it was not easy at all.
Okay.
Well, I think we should do the second half of our quiz. Just when you thought it was safe, Pete, I've got some more questions here for a Pacific Theater quiz. Let's see if we can pull up some different music that is a little more World War II friendly. Okay. What is the name of the island where much of the story in the musical South Pacific takes place? Is it Ballyhay? Is it Espiritu Santo? Or is it a fictional unnamed island? A, B, or C?
Well, I know Ballyhay is a song. So I would say Ballyhay.
Well, I know it was a fictional island.
Which is also a fictional island, so that's kind of a...
A and C.
We'll give it to you anyway. Yeah. All right, what was the largest naval battle of World War II? Was it the Battle of Leyte Gulf, the Battle of the Coral Sea, or the Battle of Guadalcanal?
Battle of Leyte Gulf.
Yes, indeed. What do you say, Leah?
I totally
agree. You agree with that? Yeah. Which character sings the song Younger Than Springtime in the musical South Pacific? Is it Lieutenant Cable? That's A. Is it B, Emile Debec? Or is it C, Bloody Mary? Which of those three? What do you say? I'll take a stab.
I'm going for Lieutenant Cable.
I'm going for B.
Well, the actual winner of that round was not Leia. It was Pete, definitely.
Good job, Pete.
Yeah, see, you know more about the musical than you think you do.
No, I'm just getting lucky.
Okay.
But MacArthur actually said, you know, when he interviewed officers, the first question he would ask is, are you lucky?
Really?
And this was something Napoleon said of his generals. I'd rather have lucky generals than good generals.
Was he? Did he know that Napoleon? That was Napoleon's question. That's why he asked it?
I have no idea. But
Striking similarity.
Okay, I've got two more questions for our quiz.
Oh.
All right. What island became a critical staging area for the planned invasion of Japan? Was it Okinawa, Saipan, or Guam? Saipan, I guess.
Well, I debate the question because both Guam and Okinawa were used as staging areas for the invasion of Japan.
Well, I'll give
Guam
you that
was
one.
The largest naval base in the Pacific.
Yeah.
In fact, there were two ports in the world in 1945 that carried most of the cargo coming into Asia and Europe, Antwerp and Guam.
Hmm.
All right.
So there you go. There's a little bit of the history.
That's excellent. So last question here. What is Nellie Forbush's home state? Nellie Forbush is a character, of course, in the opera, or the musical South Pacific. What is her home state? So I'll give you three options to choose from. And they've got one option repeated here, okay? So you only have two options. Is it Kansas or Arkansas? Kansas or Arkansas? What do you say, Pete?
Well, my daughter went to the University of Kansas. Go Jayhawks. So I will say Kansas.
I'm going to say Arkansas.
Yeah, it was Arkansas.
I got one.
Yeah. For some reason, I had Arkansas twice. Oh, well. Good timing with the music there.
Yeah, that was nice. I'm really curious to know what are some of the advancements in maybe military strategy or military tactics that came out of this period, out of this theater, and what are some of the things that we're still maybe using today from fighting in the South Pacific? Or I have no idea.
Any kind of equipment.
Some malaria medication. Yeah. I don't know. What is...
Most of the advancements were in the naval and air realms. Okay. So the infantry teams learned how to use various weapons. Flamethrowers were introduced,
ooh,
which are no longer legal in by the law of war.
Because they're too...
Because it's... seen as inhumane to burn people to death.
Is napalm also outlawed?
That's a good question. I'm assuming yes, but okay. Napalm was used extensively in the Philippines campaign.
Oh,
yeah. I mean, tens of thousands of gallons would be dumped on single hills in order to burn away the vegetation, and then the soldiers could see the Japanese cave defenses that would be bared by the napalm. But the soldiers learned how to use machine guns and Browning automatic rifles, satchel charges, demolitions, hand grenades, phosphorus grenades, and flamethrowers in order to deal with these Japanese fortifications, which were just so hard to take otherwise. Hundreds and thousands of casualties in the Buna campaign because we had no way, early on, we had no way to deal with these, in that case, coconut log bunkers that were just above the water table in this malarial jungle.
Mm.
On the naval and air sides, though, there were huge advances. The carrier battle group, which is still with us today, was developed in the interwar period, but perfected during World War II. General George Kenney, the 5th Air Force commander who worked for MacArthur, would develop these unique techniques like skip bombing. Think of tossing a rock on a pond and having it skip. Well, he would do the same thing with B-25 bombers and have them drop a bomb that would skip along the surface of the water and then hit a Japanese ship in the side where it could do more damage and sink it. And that had a huge impact on the Battle of the Bismarck Sea, which was a major American victory.
Is skip bombing still a thing?
No,
okay.
It's not. We have GPS-guided weapons and
right.
other ways
right,
of
Leah?
Hitting.
Yeah.
but there were, you know.
Thank you, Brad.
Yes.
One of the interesting notes is Charles Lindbergh went to the South Pacific.
Right.
And MacArthur said, I'm going to give you to General Kenney, and he's got a problem with his P-38 fighters. They don't go far enough. They go 500 miles. We need them to go 800 miles on a tank of gas. And Charles Lindbergh actually flew in some P-38s, and he figured out how the technical techniques to extend the range of the P-38s. It was a huge...
Oh, wow.
And while he was doing it, as a civilian, he shot down a Japanese
plane. No way.
Oh, it was kept so hush-hush because he wasn't in uniform, as he wasn't supposed to do that.
So, the range, the flying range of these Air Force crafts were improved over Air Force crafts?
Yes, and then that was before they put in drop tanks, which extended him even further. So that enabled, for instance, that 500-mile leap to Hollandia, which was such a huge strategic bonus for MacArthur in the spring of 1944.
Okay.
Thinking back to everything that you said about the soldiers who were in the thick of things, they were on the ground, and their experiences, people don't have that today. When you talk to your students, do you see them engaging with you? And what is the message that you think that people should glean from the fact that we had this war? We've had multiple wars and atrocities and what have you that we don't have today. And so how do you think it affects people's thinking and persona?
Well, those wars are still with us today.
Yeah.
Think of what's happening in Ukraine right now.
That's true.
Which has all the same elements, including the atrocities. It's just that the United States, other than the wars in Iraq and Afghanistan, haven't been involved in these really major wars since say, Vietnam.
Mm-hmm.
But the students at Ohio State are intensely interested in World War II and military history. We've developed a study abroad program for World War II, and every year we've got 20 students going over to London, Normandy, Paris, Krakow, and Berlin to learn about World War II and the Holocaust.
Mm-hmm.
Whatever classroom they give me to teach my course on World War II, I fill it up. And so students today want to know more about that period of time. They often have heard about the big one from their grandfathers or their great-grandfathers, or, you know, that's passed down through family lore. And so learning what it was really like on the ground as opposed to sort of the fuzzy memories that have been passed down is, I think, important.
Well, we had a World War II veteran on the show last time around, and he's 99 years old and actually served in World War II in the Pacific Theater, and talks about Admiral Nimitz as being, you know, the one that the soldiers all look to, as opposed to General MacArthur. I wonder if you have any comment about that?
Well, it depends where you were. I mean, if you were in the Central Pacific, you did look towards Nimitz. If you were in the Southwest Pacific, you never saw him. Wow. And it was MacArthur who was your commander. The soldiers didn't revere MacArthur the way that...
he revered himself?
Yes. The way that, say, Slim's soldiers really revered him in the Burma campaign. MacArthur thought at a much higher level. MacArthur's forte was not really tactics, and it was not really his relationship with his soldiers. It was more his strategic sense and his ability to find commanders who were competent and who could work together under his direction to get the job done at the least cost. And there's a lot to be said for that.
One of the things that I'm always curious about, and as we've put this grant project together and the podcast with some of our events, you know, it's important for us as an opera company when we tell these stories through art is to, you know, hear more than just one point of view. And so we are bringing in other members or other people to this podcast project from Japan who are survivors in some way of World War II. And my question for you, Pete, is I'm not really sure I know exactly what the Japanese objective was in the Pacific. I know it was to, you know, probably cause damage to the United States, but after Pearl Harbor, you know, what was the Japanese end goal here? Was it the invasion of mainland China?
I think it was more reactionary, at least the Pearl Harbor incident. I mean, maybe, Pete, you can talk a little bit about that and how the Japanese viewed that tragedy.
Well, with the onset of the Great Depression, the Japanese sought autarky. In other words, they wanted to control all the raw materials their economy needed to function. They believed that would be on the Asian mainland, mainly in China. So in 1931, they took over Manchuria. In 1937, they used a incident at the Marco Polo Bridge near Beijing to launch a full-scale invasion of China. But then they got stuck. They couldn't defeat China. China is just too big, its population too much. And so Japan, you know, was looking around for a war-winning strategy. At the same time, the United States had a role in China at the time. We had missionaries there. We had trade with China. And we wanted an open door for that trade, not China under Japanese control. We put in a series of embargoes against Japan, and that ultimately resulted in an embargo on oil exports to Japan. The United States was the primary oil producing nation of the time. We are today too, thanks to the fracking revolution. But that put Japan on the horns of a dilemma because they were literally running out of oil. That embargo went into place in the summer of 1941, and Japan had about a year of oil stocks left, and then it would have to surrender. And so they said, okay, well, what we're going to do next is the Southern strategy. We're going to seize the oil we need in the Dutch East Indies, modern-day Indonesia, and we're going to start that, though, by crippling the U.S. Pacific Fleet with this surprise attack on Pearl Harbor. Then we're going to seize this area in the Pacific Ocean, which has all these island groups, and we're going to fortify them. And the assumption there was the United States was not going to be, was not going to have the will to take the casualties necessary to kick the Japanese out of the area that it had gained, and that ultimately we would agree to some sort of negotiated solution rather than attacking through these island chains and defeating Japan.
Yeah, which we did.
Yes, the assumption was dead wrong, and part of it was dead wrong because they didn't see what their own attack on Pearl Harbor had done to galvanize the American people. Yeah. The America First Committee, which was this isolationist group back then, disappeared overnight as a political force in the United States. So it was a strategy that made sense to them and was completely wrong.
I wonder, so if they hadn't attacked Pearl Harbor, could, do you think there could have been a future possibility where the United States and Japan had negotiated some kind of, you know, release of the embargo or...
Well, it got us into the Second World War.
Well, that's what I'm saying. Without that attack, could there have been a possible solution for
Right,
Japan?
So this is what the alternative is, that they just attack the British base at Singapore and they take the Dutch East Indies, and then does America join in? I think we do. I think at that point, the United States probably would have ended up in the war with Japan, but maybe not with Germany.
Yeah.
Not clear that the United States would have joined the war against Germany as early as we did unless Hitler declared war on us, which he did 4 days after Pearl Harbor. Right.
So how did that work out then with the attack of Pearl Harbor? That was an immediate declaration of war then on Japan. What happened congressionally to also declare? Were they declarations of war on Germany at the same time?
So the next day after Pearl Harbor, the president asked for a declaration of war against Japan. That was passed almost unanimously. And then on December 11th, Hitler declared war on the United States.
Oh,
and then,
I didn't know that.
So we didn't really have a choice at that point. We were at war with Germany.
Yeah.
Interesting. You know, I've never, in all my 40 years on this planet, I haven't put those pieces together, Brad.
Well, this is the place to do it.
Yeah. I want to spend a little bit more time on the atomic bomb. I think that, you know, that's sort of the Trump card in the whole theater. And I'm, can you maybe for our listeners lead us, you know, what were some of the, what was happening in the Pacific War with casualties, with the fighting? How was it going? And do we believe as Americans at this point in history that it truly did, the bombs were actually there to save lives?
So Douglas MacArthur had declared the Philippines campaign over at the end of June 1945. And about the same time, the campaign for Okinawa came to an end. And so we had the bases we needed. And the next step was going to be an invasion of Japan, beginning with the island of Kyushu in the south in November 1945. That was Operation Olympic. And then the invasion of Honshu would follow in 1946. That was Operation Coronet. At the same time, we had the Manhattan Project coming to fruition.
Mm-hmm.
And the first atomic detonation was in the United States, in New Mexico in
July,
and they figured out that was a plutonium weapon because they didn't know if the plutonium bombs would work.
Mm-hmm.
So that's the one they wanted to test. They were absolutely sure the uranium bomb would work, but we only had two of them.
Mm-hmm.
So they got those ready to go. And then the decision was put forward to President Truman, do we use these? And he looked at a number of factors. How many casualties would we take if we had to invade Japan? You know, what would be the role of the atomic weapon in the post-war period? Would it give us a diplomatic edge against the Soviets? Although the Cold War hadn't started there, there were some thoughts that, you know, the Soviet Union would be a strategic competitor in the post-war period. Maybe we should just demonstrate the bomb to the Japanese, you know, put on an island offshore. There were a lot of these sort of things batted back and forth. But finally, in the Potsdam Conference of July 1945, the Allies put out a statement that basically said, Japan must surrender its armed forces unconditionally or face destruction.
Mm-hmm.
The Japanese looked at that and they go, well, that's different from unconditional surrender. And they thought the Allies were maybe backing off because they were war weary. And so instead of taking the hint to surrender, they said basically, no, we're going to continue to fight. And they tried to work diplomatic channels through the Soviet Union, which was neutral in the Pacific War at this time, and trying to work diplomatic channels there, which did not work. So Truman decided to drop the bomb. Now, in retrospect, a couple things. One is, it wasn't just the first bomb that mattered. It was the fact that there were two bombs 3 days apart, and the Japanese didn't know how many bombs we had.
Right.
And so all of a sudden they're like, oh boy, we get a city destroyed every 3 days. We're, you know, oops.
Yeah.
At the same time, right in between those two events, the Soviet Union invades Manchuria. And now Japan's last diplomatic lifeline has been taken away. So all of these things put pressure on the war cabinet. But the person who made the decision to surrender was the Emperor Hirohito. And he and his loyal lieutenants forced that on the part of the war cabinet that didn't want to surrender. In retrospect, the two atomic bombs, I would argue, and some historians have argued, saved lives. Because Japan, over the winter of 45-46, probably would have been in a starvation mode. The next target in the strategic bombing campaign was the transportation network within Japan. They would not have been able to move food around the country. Mm-hmm. And when MacArthur got there with the occupation troops, the first thing he confronted was this potential mass starvation. And it was MacArthur who convinced President Truman to have U.S. grain shipped to Japan to save the Japanese people from starvation. So had the Japanese continued to fight into 1946, there would have been millions of casualties, civilian casualties, due to starvation. And the fact that several hundred thousand Japanese died to atomic bombing but ended the war, you can see the balance there.
Do you see a modern-day possibility that the use of an atomic weapon like that is...
I don't think so, because in that context, the Japanese didn't know what the weapon was, didn't have any capacity to retaliate. There is such a proliferation of nuclear weapons today that it is unlikely that the use of a nuclear weapon would go unchallenged.
Right.
The other thing we could talk about, because I think this is in the musical, is the role of coast watchers and guerrillas.
Okay.
Right.
And I also want to know, because you mentioned that no one ever saw the natives when they were on these islands. So, like, how is it that a love story could happen in this kind of context?
Two love stories happen in the operetta, the musical.
Okay.
What was the question?
A very vibrant imagination from the writers.
Yeah. So my question is then back to the musical. What are some of the things that, you know, they absolutely get wrong? And what are, you know, maybe some key differences? You mentioned that soldiers didn't interact much with the actual native islanders themselves. So how is it that there could be a true story of a soldier falling in love with a native woman?
So there was one exception to that rule, and that is the coast watchers and the guerrillas, of which there were hundreds, if not thousands, and in the case of the Philippines, tens of thousands to hundreds of thousands of guerrillas fighting against the Japanese. MacArthur put together a group called the Allied Intelligence Bureau. It was his version of the OSS, or the Office of Strategic Services, and he used it to develop strategic intelligence, but to insert these teams into these islands behind Japanese lines often, and they would report what they saw, intelligence, back to his headquarters in Brisbane, Australia. And he also have teams go in to support the guerrilla movement, especially in the Philippines, which developed into one of the most powerful guerrilla movements in history.
Really?
One of the things my book talks about is how the Philippines had agency in their own liberation through these tens of thousands of guerrillas that supported the U.S. Forces as they waded ashore and operated behind Japanese lines. So if you were a coast watcher, if you were a guerrilla team leader, you had intimate contact with the natives.
I see. Okay.
Yeah. Well, as far as the musical goes, I mean, it was a huge success when it premiered 75 years ago, and Toledo Opera is doing it for the 75th anniversary of the show, right? It's happening on February
14th,
which is Valentine's Day. In time for
Valentine's Day. The same.
And there's also a Sunday matinee, which is, I don't have it
16th.
Listed here. The
yep.
16th. There you go. Yeah, it makes sense that it was only 2 days later,
yep.
right? Okay.
Where's that sound for that?
There you go.
Thanks, Brad.
Rodgers and Hammerstein had a big success with Oklahoma. They wrote another musical, I think, before that. And this was maybe their third musical, I think, that they wrote, South Pacific, based on James Mitchell's novel. But their idea was to turn it into a commercial property, to make, like, a story out of it that they could use the South Pacific Theater as, you know, a backdrop or whatever. Yeah. They wanted two things, basically. Number one was to make money, which they did. Mm-hmm. And number two was to make a show with progressive ideas about racism, which they did also as mm-hmm. well. Was the idea of racism even a thing at that time?
No, not really, other than the Double V campaign in the United States. So the black community viewed World War II as an opportunity to defeat fascism abroad and gain civil rights at home. Mm-hmm. The Double V or Double Victory that they were shooting for. And it really sort of led into the civil rights movement of the 1950s and 1960s.
Well, that's another entirely different podcast.
Yeah, fascinating.
But mm-hmm. It is interesting, isn't it? Mm-hmm. Well, thank you so much. Dr. Peter Mansour is on faculty at Ohio State University, a noted historian, author, military man, colonel, et cetera, all those things that you should say instead of me if I get anything wrong. But thank you for coming in and making the trip up here and talking with us today here on Opera Out of the Box.
My pleasure, and I look forward to the musical.
You've been listening to Opera Out of the Box, a co-production of WGTE Public Media and Toledo Opera, with additional support from Ohio Humanities. You can find previous episodes online at our website, WGTE.org, and of course you can dive into all things Toledo Opera and South Pacific at their website, which is ToledoOpera.org. I want to thank my guests one more time today, Leah Whitaker and Dr. Peter Mansour. I'm your host, Brad Cresswell, and you've been listening to Opera Out of the Box.